Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Human Rights Demand. Hello, Bob Darby. How are you today?
I'm okay, Mary. Thanks for calling in. It's good talking with you.
Absolutely. We're so glad to have you with us today, Bob. We have missed you, and we are glad that you're back to advocate for the homeless people, especially the homeless mentally ill. And, of course, we talk about other issues that affect people, poverty issues. And so we want to welcome all the callers. I want to let you know that we have major COINTELPRO issues. COINTELPRO set our time back on open air to just 30 minutes, even though I pay for 2 hours. We'll be on the air for at least an hour and a half because the first part of the show is Bob Darby, human rights advocate, and the second part of the show is Lynn Eaglefeather, also a human rights advocate. And I ask you to get your calls in within the next 23 minutes. And once you're on air with us, you can stay even when we're no longer on live, but we will archive this report along with all our other reports. So therefore, you will be able to take the links and share them with whomsoever you please. So I want to welcome you, Bob Darby, to Human Rights Demand. Bob Darby is an advocate for the homeless, and you have a caller already on 7043, sir. Go right ahead.
Well, go ahead and let's listen to it.
Okay, 7043, would you like to have a word? 7043, would you like to have a word?
Hello?
Okay. Hello, 7043.
This is Elizabeth Mary, Elizabeth Gaskin.
Hey, Elizabeth, how are you today?
I've not been well, but I'm okay today.
Wonderful.
I've had my thyroid.
We're glad to have you back. Oh, this is Elizabeth Gaskins. Is that right, Elizabeth?
That's correct.
Oh, Elizabeth, we're so glad to hear from you. How excellent it is. And I thank you for calling in today. Do you have a message for us on behalf of the homeless or the mentally ill or both?
All of the above, too. Yes, I do.
Okay.
I'm going to listen today in. I'm not going to be able to talk. I've not been well with my thyroid. I've had some thyroid problems, so I'm just going to listen. Thank you, Mary and Bob and Lynn.
Okay, well, thank you. Elizabeth Gaskins is from the Cherokee Nation, and she hosted the Native American Affairs Program, Bob, for about a month. And so I'm so glad that she called in today. And we're going to leave it to you to bring us up to speed on what is happening to the homeless, also the homeless mentally ill, Bob. We'll give it to you.
Well, the theme that I would like to discuss and that hopefully people will call in concerning is the privatization of the prison system, the burgeoning effect of more and more being created, and also the privatization of the probation and parole system. According to a lot of information on the Internet, if you just Google privatization of the prison system or privatization of the parole system or probation system, you'll get a lot of information. I have been Googling this myself, and according to the information I have, the majority of states have already privatized their probation system so that anyone who is on probation for an offense, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, must have to answer to a privatized probation or parole system and pay their fee. So people are released from prison on probation and parole or from jail on probation and parole, and they are immediately hit with a large bill from parole systems and probation systems. And in some cases, I don't know the actual percentage, but it's a significant percentage according to the information, the various information I've gotten off the Internet. Even in some cases, the prison and jail system in the country actually tries to extract past due room and board fees for being in jail or prison. So they make it almost impossible for a person who has been released on probation or prison to stay out of jail because they had to pay fees. You've heard about this, haven't you, Mary? Mary, are you there?
Bob, I am here. I turned my mic off so that background noise from my house won't disturb your presentation. So,
okay,
yes,
well,
I have heard. I knew that there were private prisons and jails, but to tell you the truth, I wasn't aware that they privatized probation offices as well.
Well, they have, and you can Google Progressive News Views, and the current week's itinerary includes a large amount of material about the burgeoning industry of probation, so private probation systems whereby the states, the counties, the municipalities contract out their probation system to private entities, which charge the person on probation for their probation. They charge them a fee to keep up with them. So if anyone is listening and has been affected by this, if they call in and give us more information, we'd appreciate it. So what does this have to do with the homeless mentally ill? It has a lot to do with the homeless mentally ill because, according to an article in the New York Times this year, more than half of all the prisoners in the United States prison system, both federal and state, have a mental health problem, according to a 2006 Justice Department study. So more than half of the people in prison and jail have a mental health system, and when they are probated, they are required to report to a corporate system that charges them for their probation charges them a fee every time they call in. And they have to call in or they'll be put back in jail. So we have a system that is, as I keep reminding people on the air, we have more people per capita in the United States in prison and jail than in any other country in the world. So we have about 3 million people in prison and jails, which is about 1% of our entire population, men, women, and children. And if you include the people who are in this system, probationary, parole, it comes out to about 2 or 3% of the adult population. So we have a rapidly expanding prison industrial complex that is being privatized. So that's a pretty dreadful situation. And Mary, would you like to talk about your perspective on that some? I mean, would you like to carry that ball some? I'm sure you know some more.
Bob, as a matter of fact, Bob, I was wondering if you had seen my wall at Facebook. I have a ticket that was issued to a person who was living in their car. The thing is that we know that you will get vagrancy tickets if you try to live outside. And so this economy had driven many people to living in their car. So now they're issuing tickets for people who are living in their cars. So in other words, a person who has a car left over from when they had a job, if they have a car left over from that, then some people were living in their cars. Sometimes whole families have lived in their cars to tide them over until they could finally get another paycheck. So I saw a ticket that had been issued to a man who was living in his car. Now, this is his car. He was lawfully parked. He had paid money for wherever he parked, or he was parked in a free place. And he got a ticket for living in his car that he owned. Now, that is saying to the homeless that you are not welcome outside on God's green earth where he put you. You have no human rights to exist free outside where God made the earth. And he says that he owns the earth and all the fullness thereof, the cattle on a thousand hills, belongs to God the Father. But people are not welcome to live outside on God's green earth because they've taken possession of God's green earth. They think it's theirs. Yes, these elitists think that all the fullness they're in is theirs. That's why they want everyone to be atheist, is because if you were all atheists, then that would make the government the higher power. Yes, the government wants to erase God. They want to make you think that he doesn't exist, and then they become the highest power. So they tell the homeless that they're not welcome to live outside on God's green earth anywhere. And then now they're saying to them, we're writing tickets, you cannot live in your car that you bought with your own money and you're legally parked, but you cannot live in your car. Not saying that you were doing something wrong. You weren't littering. You weren't disturbing the peace with loud music. You were just living in your car. And we're not going to allow you to do that. And then meanwhile, we're closing down the homeless shelters. Yes, we're not going to supplement you with housing because we've taken your job and sent it behind bars for prison labor and sent it overseas for cheap labor. We're not going to let you have even shelter. We're closing down the shelters. And so what is happening is the elitists are doing genocide against the homeless. They don't want them to have homeless shelters. They don't want them to live in their cars, and they better not be caught sleeping outside. So where does that leave but their private jails and prisons? So I say to you that the homeless are being pushed into private jails and prisons so that they can extract tax money from already overtaxed Americans in order to get it for prison profits. Now, I want you to know, Bob, that I just left a site online where the people were complaining because some people are on food stamps. Yes, the people were complaining because some people have Section 8 housing. Yes, the people were complaining about any benefits at all to the poor. But I don't hear any complaints about the money that is spent by taxpayers to warehouse people in jails and prisons, which is much more expensive than a couple of $100s for food stamps a month, which is much more expensive than a few $100s for a Section 8 house, complain because they're having to spend $168,000 per year to warehouse one person in prison in New York. So I think that this whole country has a backward attitude. They're not getting back any money they take from a family for food stamps. They're not getting back any refunds on money that is saved when they kick a family out of Section 8 housing. They're not getting any money back on their taxes when they close a homeless shelter. Get it straight. You're not getting any tax money back no matter who you defraud, no matter who you kick out of their jobs, no matter who you kick out of their homes, no matter who you see hungry. You're not getting any of that tax money back because the United States of America will find another country that they feel deserves your money more than you do. So it does not benefit taxpayers one bit to be evil toward the poor because you're not getting your tax money back no matter what you do. As a matter of fact, if you keep on living long enough, you yourself will very likely be poor, Mr. Middle Class. So I want to turn you back over to Bob Darby. Bob Darby?
Yes, yes. And much of the money that is a part of our national treasury is being spent on so-called defense, and that accounts for about a three I believe the total federal budget is $3 trillion. That's $3,000 billion. A third of that, $1,000 billion, or $1 trillion, is spent on defense, which means the defense industries, where we have by far the most extravagant for defense of any country in the world. And what this results in is a huge overproduction and surplus of weaponry, which we sell to other countries, and that the United States military gives to domestic police departments. You notice in the most recent incident in Ferguson, when people were protesting the murder of Michael Brown, the police came out in armored vehicles that they had obtained, that they had been given by the government. And why does the government give these away? Because they are grossly oversupplied with weaponry, with military weaponry. So what they do is so they give this surplus weaponry to police, to some local police, who use that in turn to suppress legitimate, very legitimate, civil dissent and protest over such things as police murder of innocent civilians, or for no real provocations, as in the case with Michael Brown, hands up, don't shoot, and getting shot anyway 6 times. So the result is we are building a militarized police state in which we have the most people per capita in the world in prison and jail. Prison and jail has become a huge industry, and the military is a huge industry and has been for a long time. We even had a president in the 1950s, Eisenhower, who was very aware of the fact that there was a great danger in the militarization of our economy, and he warned against the military-industrial complex. Well, 60 years after he made that warning, we have a completely militarized nation, a militarized and prisonized nation. So what has happened with regard to what I talk about, the homeless mental ill? Well, the solution to mental illness is no longer medical care for those who have to turn to charity or the government for their care, but prison and jail. So if someone is unlucky enough to not have insurance, not have family resources, and develops a mental illness, and they stand an extremely high chance of ending up in prison and jail. And in many states, if you're convicted of just three misdemeanors, I believe, you're in danger of being indefinitely in prison. Well, if you're homeless and mentally ill, or you're just homeless, and you have nowhere to go, you're liable to be arrested for vagrancy, you're liable to be arrested for urinating in public, you're liable to be arrested for practically just loitering or any number of different minor offenses. And if these add up to a large enough police ledger, they can just hold you indefinitely. And then if they release you and you can't find a place to live and you try to live in an abandoned house, or in a junkyard, or in a car, or something like that, they arrest you for doing that. So you have literally no place to turn, and the police are out on the prey looking for people who are helpless to arrest and to harass. So it's not just the homeless mentally ill. It's people who have no resources who are being criminalized, the poor who are being criminalized in this country. And it's a dreadful situation, and it's getting worse. And to give you an idea of how much it has worsened for the mentally ill, in 1955, there was one bed in a psychiatric ward for every 300 Americans, but now there is one for every 3,000 Americans, the New York Times said in a 2010 study. So they're criminalizing poverty, they're criminalizing uninsured illness, and most particularly mental illness. So all of this with a smiley face And, you know, this country is turning into a police state. It's already a police state, and it's going to get worse. So one description I heard of in the Progressive News, I read in the Progressive News on the Internet, it said we have a vampire economy. We have the wealthy, the super wealthy and the rich sucking the lifeblood out of everyone below them who does not contribute to their wealth, to the wealth of the super rich. And when they cannot contribute anything directly, they put them in jails and prisons, which are corporations or reparations, and they find a way to enrich themselves from that. So, Mary, would you talk some about your experience with the incarcerated mentally ill? You have a lot to say about that. You had a family member who was gruesomely victimized as an incarcerated mentally ill person. Mary, a lot of people maybe haven't heard about that on this program. Are you there? Mary, are you on the air?
I am on the air, Bob. I turn my mic off so I can close out background noises and hear you speak to the public about the homeless mentally ill and also the and how the poor are being punished for living. Basically, they're being penalized for being alive. And I want to invite the radio audience to call in. You have 3 minutes to call in because COINTELPRO keeps changing our time. I pay for 2 hours. However, they keep changing the time to 30 minutes. So after the show today, I'm going to delete all future shows for Bob Darby and for Lynn Eaglefeather, and I'm going to start anew with a brand new show that will be called Bob Darby and Lynn Eaglefeather, Advocates for the Poor and Homeless and Mentally Ill, because I think your show covers all three of those areas. And very often those three areas congeal and become one area, and that is the poor, homeless, mentally ill. But sometimes people can be homeless, as you pointed out, without being mentally ill. And you're so right about that. Sometimes the mentally ill can be sick without being homeless. You're so right about that. And sometimes a person can be poor and still manage to keep a roof over their head thanks to friends, neighbors, family, and sometimes government benefits. And we're very thankful for that. So those three areas don't have to congeal, but very often when we do see all three of those areas congeal together, then we've got a triple whammy. And all you have to do to make that mix worse is add Black or Latino or Native American to the description. Anytime you add a minority, the fact that a person is poor, homeless, and mentally ill, when you add that they're from a minority, then you get a recipe for real disaster, for real human and civil rights brutality and abuses. And I want to just let everyone know that I'm going to read a list of 14 people who've been killed by police since July 17th. I want everybody to know it's not just Michael Brown that people are upset about. 14 people, and many of them, over half of them, are mentally ill people who were killed by police. And that's the usual statistic. Most victims of police violence are your mentally ill citizens of the United States of America. So I'm going to ask you to stay tuned and hear the list. And I want to thank you for coming to Human Rights Demand this August 28th. What is this? The August 29th,
28th, I believe, right.
And we want to appreciate you, Bob. We're going to continue on with the show, but our audience is being cut off right now because COINTELPRO goes in and adjusts my tab. But they can come back and listen to the whole show on tape and hear the list of victims of police July 17th. So I want to give Ms. Gaskins another chance to ask a question or speak before we go any further in case she has something to say. Ms. Gaskins, did you have anything to add to what we've said or a question or comment?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me, Bob, Mary, Lynn?
Yes, yes, I can hear you.
I presently today have a mentally ill inmate in my home that's on an anklet. He's out of Illinois. As you will know, Illinois is the biggest prison system there is in the state. He is mentally challenged. He's a 50-year-old man, got the mind of a 9-year-old child, has spent 15 years in prison for driving while under the influence of alcohol. The third charge was a Class X felony on him, and he presently resides in my residence. I had spoke with him about your program, and he would like to come on and speak as long as I'm here with him as an advocate representing his incarceration in the state of Illinois. Hello?
Elizabeth, thank you. Is he ready to speak now?
At this time, he's not, Mary. I will bring him on. He is very skeptical of people. He's a very much a crime victim himself, being beaten in the prison system, tasered, and things have happened to him. I have to sit down with him when I get him on the speakerphone, and he will speak on your program. His name's Randolph Plody. His number is B77027 of the state of Illinois. And he will speak. I will put some pictures up of him. He's long-haired biker, motorcycle boy, and his family, he comes from a millionaire family of the state of Illinois, but he is mentally challenged.
Well, we look forward to Clody coming on this show and speaking, don't we, Bob?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do look forward to it.
Randolph can tell you things about the state of Illinois, why he's been in 5-6 different prisons here. We're just getting ready to open up our federal prison here in the state of Illinois in Thompson. I fear the inmates that are coming here. We have a new warden, and I fear for their protection and everyone's protection when they bring them here to our county. And this is very much something I want to be involved with you and Mary and Lynn and all y'all with the prison system, too, and as well as the mentally incarcerated, as well as the mentally ill and the homeless, too. Not just our native. Yes, Wado, thank you. I'll turn it back to you.
No, go ahead. I have a feeling you had something more to say.
Well, I'm just concerned over the way our government is taking the money and using it. Like with Randolph, if he's homeless, he has nowhere else to go. He has no family. Where does he go? He'll be put back in the prison system to stay for life, and then they'll eventually institute. Now we have a law, the governor of Illinois made a law, Governor Quinn, that if they're mentally ill, they're to be placed into a mental facility here if they're coming from the prison system. Well, that's not fair to the inmates. They have never committed a violent crime to any person. There's no injured party here. And they're going to place them as the mentally ill in a facility that are third X, like Randy, his third time Class X felony, but he has a misdemeanor or minor traffic violation. Has now become Class X felonies in the United States, which is bogus. And the Uniform Commercial Code laws, if you'll read them, you have to have an injured party under the United States laws. You're entitled to your constitution with counsel being present. And all of him, ineffective counsel, has been given to him all along. And they've never in the courts introduced in the courts that he had a mental illness. He's never been that privilege in the state of Illinois to present his evidence. But yet the Supreme Court this time found him not guilty on a traffic violation, and they extended his sentencing for 6 years. He's got to do to the state right now. He's been in 3 years, and he's got 2 more years to stay out. And heaven knows if they're going to rearrest him again on another bogus charge and keep him institutionalizing. I fear this for him and anyone that has been in the prison system, coming out of the prison system, how they're treating these inmates.
Well, is he required to see a probationary officer?
Oh, yeah, he comes here. He does drop by anytime he wants. He doesn't tell us when he's going to come in. He does random drug testing on him and checks on him, and he's whenever he wants. He doesn't get to go anywhere. He's allowed to be out from 8 to 6 in the afternoon. That's working. And on Fridays, he can be out to 10 p.m., and other than that, he's on an anklet at home monitored. He's got a GPS on him. They know where he's at all time. And
well,
I'm living the prison life with him because I'm his host to the prison system, and I'm just as responsible for him as the PO is.
Well, they're not charging him for his probation service, are they?
Well, I don't know at this time if they would. I've not heard of that yet, Bob.
He has no income, does he?
Well, yes, he does receive a child check. He has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. He was born with mental retardation.
Right.
Randolph, he gets a check from his family, but when he's in the prison system, they take that disability check from him, and then they have to wait 4 or 5 months later to get it back when he can't release from Department of Corrections.
And then he has to pay the probation officer out of that disability check?
Yes, he's had to pay fines and stuff before he get his check, yes.
That's what I meant. So that they actually charge someone who's been probated or paroled for their privatized probation or parole services. So
that's correct. That's correct. They do. Like with Randolph, we live in a small area, and his conditions on his parole, he's supposed to see a psych doctor, take psych medicines, go to alcohol treatment centers, and all this. But he has no way of getting there. He has no driver's license. And I asked the parole officer, I said, how are you going to get him to complete your program when he has no transportation? He come back and told me, well, that's my responsibility. I said, wait a minute. I don't get paid by the Department of Correction to keep him on an anklet, and I don't get paid by your department to take him back and forth. I believe that's your responsibility to make sure he gets this before he's released out of your Department of Corrections. So I don't know where we're going to lead with this one. I mean, he basically told me that he cannot be off his anklet or get off parole unless he completes these drug and alcohol mental health treatments, which is not going to help him in all his documents, because Randolph will die an alcoholic. He is an alcoholic. He has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. There's no cure for this. It's a disease that he has lived with his whole entire life.
How does he spend the day? How does he spend his time at home?
As an alcoholic.
Does he drink?
Yes. Yes. His parole officer knows he drinks, too. He's a nonstop drinker, yes. He's an alcoholic.
Well, how does he get his
alcohol? What's that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
How does he get his alcohol? He goes to the store to buy it?
Yes. Yes, they allow him to buy his alcohol. It's legal in the state of Illinois. And I can say this, back in the prohibition time in the state of Illinois, there was a prescription that was given to the alcoholics because it was an epidemic, giving it to the Native Americans back in the day. So they come up with a prescription for the alcoholic that doctor would have to give the alcohol to them that slowed down on this disease that they have today. But it no longer exists in the state of Illinois, the prohibition time. The alcohol prescription doesn't exist anymore.
But some of the time these are confined to your home, right? With an ankle.
He's here now.
He's released from that to go to the liquor store to buy liquor, right?
Yes, he can walk around the neighborhood and be drunk all day long. They don't say anything to him. Don't care if he drops dead. They could care less of his disease that he has. He has severe fetal alcohol disease, and it's not fair to Randolph because he did not ask for this disease. He was born with it, and there's no help in the state of Illinois for him.
Well, it's a pretty dreadful situation, and I'm afraid that although I've never heard of anyone with this particular affliction, I'm sure that there are many millions of other people who have similar situation in this country. So you just have to live with it, and it's a terrible thing to have to live with, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I worry about the ones that are coming out of the Department of Corrections. Where do we put them? I mean, if I didn't have him a place to live, like Mary, you said, they would be right back in the prison system being charged with another charge. No, eventually they're going to keep him there and make money off of him.
Well, they have a three strikes, you're out program in some states. So that if you have, apparently they don't have that in Illinois yet. So
yeah, they do. That's why they gave him the Class X felony. Yes, three strikes and you're out. He was three misdemeanors he had, and they gave him the truth in sentencing, which was the three strikes, you're out, and that's why he got the Class X felony on him. That's why he's got to wear the anklet.
So he's trapped, basically. They've turned your home into a jail for him, right?
Yes, I'm living a prison system's life here. Yes, I am.
Mm. Are you able to leave the house and do things and without him? Do you have to supervise him all the time yourself to keep up with him?
Yes, most of the time I can leave the home, but when I come back, he's done something funny. I mean, that normal, like a kid would. He's like a child. He's done something that if I go, like I went to the store the other day and I went to a town meeting the other day when I come back home and he took the water hose and sprayed the whole house off, whole porch off, the screen and everything. It was soaking wet and because he was intoxicated and I said, I wished he hadn't done, but these are things that he would do out of abnormal, not thinking that because of his disease and his drinking too. And I come home to a whole soaked off porch and everything was soaking wet, but it's okay. I mean, I have to deal with these things with him.
Well, I admire your kind treatment and taking care of this man, Randolph. He's lucky to have you.
Yeah.
And how long have you been taking care of him?
Well, I've known him for 20 years, and for the past 6-7 years now, he's been in my home. I've taken care of him. Sometimes I ask him not to drink, and he has tremors, and he can't go without alcohol, and he has now got some medical issues from the prison system that has accumulated them today that are very serious. I have not yet got him to an expert, but he was given medical drugs there, medicine there while he was incarcerated, and it's caused some side effects.
So you're really trapped. There's nothing you can do but just put up with the situation, right?
Right. Randolph will pass as an alcoholic. We already know that. Everyone knows he'll pass as an alcoholic.
So what life do you have? How are you living? Are you not working, are you?
Not presently. No, I'm not working.
So how are you paying your rent and getting by?
Well, I receive a little check. I own my own home. I'm a homeowner here. I bought my house and paid for it. And no taxes. I just own the taxes and the utilities. I live off of a little check.
Well, I admire what you're doing. You're taking care of Randolph and taking care of yourself. And you sound like an extraordinarily patient person to be able to survive this. I'm lucky, too. I'm almost 70 years old. I'm 69, and I'm living in senior housing in Atlanta, which is subsidized by the numerous government and private agencies. But I have a small apartment. And I did work most of my life, most of my adult life, and I'm lucky. You know, I'm lucky, although sometimes it gets lonely in this HUD-subsidized apartment. But if it weren't for the government helping me, the government is still helping some people. And they're, when they cut off their aid to dependent people like elders like me and people who are disabled like Randolph and like you, then we're going to be in real trouble. And they may do that because they'd like to have more money for themselves. So, I'm presently okay myself, although my health is deteriorating as I approach the age of 70. But I don't have any problems with alcohol or mental health presently, so I'm lucky. And I'm trying to spend my surplus time as much as I can educating myself and trying to do something about the deteriorating situation where I live in Atlanta with shelters closing and with outreach services for the homeless and mentally ill diminishing. And at least I can do is protest, and that's why I'm on this program.
Yeah.
But we're afloat, you and I and Mary. We're afloat, and we're trying to fight the system as it excludes millions of people and puts millions of people in prison and jail. So thank you for doing what you're doing, Elizabeth. I appreciate it.
Yes. You know, Bob, I have a home here. I've got a 7-bedroom home. And in our county, we don't have a homeless shelter for anyone to come and go to when they're coming out of prison.
You don't have one at all?
No, we don't have a homeless shelter at all in our county, but yet we have a federal prison getting ready to open up here next year. I bring this to the city council, but they don't care. I mean, this used to be the war. Savannah, Illinois used to be the Army depot for the military. So they don't even have a homeless shelter. The nearest homeless shelter we have here is 40, 60 miles away.
So you have a lot of people on the streets.
That's correct. We have a lot of suicide here in our little town and people that are homeless, yes. Yes, we have homeless. They live under the bridges, and they live along the railroad train tracks, and they live wherever they can around here.
And if they're lucky, they may live in cars or
yes, they
abandoned
ride bicycles.
Buildings.
Yes, they do. They live in abandoned buildings here. Yeah, we have a lot of them around here, and we do have the homeless that are staying in the buildings. Some of them do during the winter times, but we have nowhere to put them in Savannah. They live homeless, live out in the winter, in the freezing cold.
Well, that's terrible. I mean, you live in a cold part of the country. I mean, you have pretty fierce winters, don't you?
Yes.
So I imagine that every winter, a large number of people freeze to death.
Yes.
So, how far are you from the? What's the nearest big city? Chicago.
I'm near Rockford, Freeport, Illinois, in Rockford.
And they have homeless shelters.
Yes, they do, but they're so overpopulated there that someone like Randolph would be kicked out because of his alcoholic disease. He wouldn't be able to be there, and also he's a convicted felon, so he would be placed in the streets to live.
Well, that's what we're trying to protest, and I hope that people are listening to this program, and they're finding out how terrible it is. Because if you stumble and fall more than once in this society, you're liable to be trampled over and just left out to die. And that's what's happened to millions of people. Nobody knows the actual number of homeless that we have in this country because they're so hard to count, but the number is great. And you have to go to a place like India, Bangladesh, or Brazil, or Ecuador, or some greatly impoverished country to find greater numbers of people living on the streets than you have in the United States. So I salute you for what you're doing there in Savannah, Illinois.
Thank you, Bob.
We must stand together, and we must help each other the way Bob Darby does. Bob Darby goes to a Feed the Homeless program every Sunday and volunteers his time to, in practical ways, to the homeless. And also, Ms. Elizabeth Gaskins is housing a man who is an alcoholic. Were it not for her love and generosity of mankind, this gentleman would no doubt be back in prison today. Instead, he has a home and he has someone to care about him. And this is outreach. This is outreach. Going and volunteering your time to actually feed the hungry and actually taking in an individual who you care about but who's unable to stand on his own. And I just so much want you both to know how much I appreciate you and how much I appreciate you living your words. You're not just coming on radio and talking about the problems and what needs to be done, but you're actually walking your talk. And if everybody would do that, then we wouldn't have nearly the problem that we have. We must walk our talk. And especially, I know that we're a secular radio show. Human Rights Demand is a secular radio show. It's not giving honor or respect to any particular religion. But I feel that if individuals would really walk their talk for most religions, if they would just walk their talk, then we wouldn't have all of the problems that we have in this world. What do you think about that, Bob and Elizabeth?
Go ahead, Bob. You go ahead. You're my elder. Go ahead.
Your elder. Okay. I think that if most people who are Christian or Jewish or Muslim, for that matter, took their religions as seriously as they might, they would do everything they could to reach out for those who are most in need, those who are abandoned, those who are scorned, as it is said in the Christian religion, the least of these. And the numbers of the least of these are multiplying very fast. And many, many millions of people in this country who delight in calling themselves Christians or Jews or Muslims, which are religions that demand that their practitioners practice charity and practice mercy. Despite that, most of the people who call themselves by these religious names do not practice their religion. They don't walk the talk, as you put it. So we're urging people to pay attention to what's going on and to do something, try to do something to help those individuals, to help those masses of people who have been marginalized and deprived of the right to live. What do you think, Elizabeth? Do you
agree with you? If everyone was to live their fruits of the Spirit and be believers of our higher power, then our world would be much better. We live in unity and see more transparency. We'd all get along, have common sense, use common sense. This is everything. There's no more common sense anymore. No one actually lives the fruit of their spirit.
All right. I wouldn't say that no one does, but certainly
not enough. We've lost the fruit of our spirit. Let me phrase that again. We've lost our fruits of our spirit, the ones that have it. We've lost it. We've all fall from grace, and that's we're supposed to fall from grace. That's what makes us stronger when we lift ourselves back up and praise the Creator for giving us another day of life.
Well, I certainly feel that way when I get up, and I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to have a roof over my head. I'm glad to have food to eat. I'm glad to have medicine for my old age infirmities. So let's just keep on doing what we're trying to do, and hopefully people will pay attention and get busy and challenge the police state we're living in and try to make this a better place for those who are least fortunate, as you're doing, as you're helping Randolph and as Mary's doing, I'm trying to do, speaking out on behalf of those who have been left out, the millions of people who have been left out in this society, and largely all in the name of the upper 1% of the population that controls over half of all the resources in this country. So, you know, we're facing the classic evils of greed and aggression and lack of sensitivity to other people that define evil. And they're in control right now. At least they seem to be in control, but they won't stay. They can't stay in control indefinitely because they'll destroy their own base, and that's what they're doing. What do you think, Mary? Mary, I'm kind of worn out right now.
Oh, I understand, Bob, and I so much appreciate you. And Elizabeth Gaskins, what an honor, what a pleasure to speak with you, a human rights advocate from the Cherokee Nation. Bob Darby, a human rights advocate of over 20 years, the founder of Food Not Bombs here in Atlanta, Georgia, a man who feeds the hungry every Sunday with a program here in Atlanta, Georgia, who's very knowledgeable and concerned, both of you, about the issues, the social issues facing the nation regarding excessive incarceration, mass incarceration, if you will. Also, all the problems that go into making that. You see, when prison investors looked around and decided that they could make money by incarcerating people, then that took the entire social network apart. In other words, the nets, the safety nets that used to be under people to keep them from falling through the cracks are being cut with scissors, because now they want people to fall through the net and land in prison. So the main problem, the way I see it, we don't have 10 problems. We don't have 50 problems. I know it feels like we do, but we really do not. To my idea, we have one major issue in the United States of America, and that is private prison investors in government. The thing is that we're allowing a conflict of interest. We're allowing our decision makers who make decisions over law and justice, who make decisions over criminal justice system, who make decisions regarding who goes to jail and who do not go to jail. We're allowing prison investors to make all of those decisions. Prison investors are deciding about your budget, what part of it, if any, will go to rescue people who are homeless. They're making decisions about whether or not Americans will have a jobs program. They're making decisions about whether or not major corporations that do most of their manufacturing and most of their assembly work overseas can then get the same tax breaks as companies that are working within America and paying minimum wage at least. So the same people who are making these decisions are your prison investors. They are prison owners and investors. So naturally, it's only natural that they will make the decisions that will make their system grow. They are making decisions about homeless shelters, about mental health treatment, about the economy that will make their prisons grow in population. Please understand that should have been expected, because the Bible says that no man can serve two masters. Now, the Bible did not say that no man will want to serve two masters. It didn't say that no man will think about serving two masters. The Bible says no man can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon. So we're putting these people who are in political offices in a very bad situation. We're letting them have prison investments, and then we're asking them to make decisions that are socially responsible. That is impossible according to the Bible. The Bible says a man cannot serve two masters. He cannot serve God and mammon. And when we say the word God, we know that we're speaking of where the Bible says that you love ye one another as I have loved you. So the only way we have as human beings to show our honor and love and respect for God is how we treat each other. So when that verse says no man can serve mammon and God, what it is saying is that no man can serve mankind and God, because serving mankind is how we serve God. We don't serve God when we get dressed and go to church on Sunday and back on Wednesday and on Saturday to choir practice. Those are wonderful things to do, but that is for our own spiritual growth and education and edification. That's not how we really serve God, understand. That is because as a Christian, we enjoy fellowshipping and we benefit spiritually by fellowshipping with other Christians. So no matter what religion you are, you don't really serve God when you gather together with other people of your same religion. You serve God only by the way you treat other people. That is the only way you have of serving God. The Bible says, such as you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do also unto me. So he's made it very clear in that you don't serve God by having the rich people to your house or by dropping the names of the millionaires that you know or by sending donations to a very wealthy politician. You don't serve God that way. I'm not saying those are bad things to do, but that's not how you serve God. He said that when you have a dinner, invite the poor and needy to dinner. He said, don't always invite just the most influential and powerful and rich people that you know. Invite, go out into the byways and highways and invite the poor, invite the needy, because that is how you serve God. So the Bible says no man, it's impossible for any man to serve mammon and God. God meaning the people. So we have asked of our elected and appointed officials to do something that we already should know is impossible. We've asked them to be prison investors, but serve us, serve the people. That is not their choice, because they can't do that. God said they can't do it, and I believe they cannot do it. They will wind up every time voting for laws that will make their prison investments grow. That's what they've been doing. That's what they will continue to do, because that is the nature of man. That is the nature of man. And God said to be anything other than that is impossible. He said, if you give a man two masters, he will hate the one and love the other. He will shun the one and cling to the other. So these prison investors that we put in the Justice Department, that we put in Congress, we put them in Senate, we put them in judges' chambers, we put them in the prosecutor's office, yes, and they're even in some public defender's office. These prison investors are going to continue making decisions that will increase their stock portfolio. Therefore, they've criminalized mental illness, they've criminalized homelessness, and they do things all the time that will add to the homeless population, and they do things all the time that will add to mentally ill people. Yes. Don't you know that stress is a great factor in mental illness? Some people who've never had a history of mental illness are losing it during these economic hardship times. So these people are continually doing things that will press Americans down. There's a war on Americans, a war. And as we talked about today, Bob mentioned Michael Brown. And I promise to tell you what's going on regarding other people who were also killed by police during this summer, which I call the summer of police terror. The summer of police terror. And I want to stop right now. And I want to let everyone know that human rights activists, human rights advocates are not against police officers. Thank God that we have police officers to call on if we need them. Thank God we have people who even have guns, because there are times when police officers have saved lives by being there with their gun, by having the authority that criminals respect more than they respect you, who are senior citizens in your home, more than they respect you who are single mothers in their home, more than they respect you who are gentlemen living alone. People who don't respect you will respect a police officer. And I am thankful that we have police officers. Human rights advocates are not against police. We're against overuse of force by police. We're not against police. We're against police brutality. We're against overuse of force by police. And yes, we're against militarization of police departments. Now, I want to read to you our body count from America's Summer of Police Terror. And this is through August 30th, as far as I know. If you know of other names that need to be on this list, I ask you to please call in and tell us about other people who've been killed by police during this summer of police terror. We have, starting out, a white gentleman. I'm going to tell you the race, the age, and the city, and the date these people were killed, and whether or not they were mentally ill, okay? So we have a white guy named Joseph Jennings. He was 18 years old. He was killed in Ottawa, Kansas on August 24th. And Joseph Jennings was mentally ill. We have a Latino guy. His name, it was Herman Milton Osorio. He was 61 years old. He's from Ellicott City, Maryland. He died on August 24th. Third, and he was mentally ill. Police shot him to death when they came to his house. Then we have a guy, I don't know his race. His name was Darren Friedman. He was 45. He was also from Ellicott City, Maryland. He was killed on August 20th. He was mentally ill. He was killed in his house also. A black man named Darius Cole Garrett was 21 years old. He was killed in Chicago, Illinois by police. He was riding his bicycle, and police said he pointed a gun at them. Frankly, I don't believe that. There was a white man who was killed. His name was Judd Winkler. He was 30 years old. He's from Los Angeles, California, and he was killed on August 19th. Now, Judd Winkler was a man who worked for a major television station on a popular TV show. He had been kidnapped. He and two other people had been kidnapped and were being robbed. John Winkler ran away from the robber, and the police had been called. When John Winkler ran out of the building, police opened fire on him. They didn't tell him to halt. They didn't ask him to identify himself. He's running away from a kidnapper and robber, and the police just opened fire on him and killed him. Talk about procedure. A black young man was killed. His name was Kajimi Powell. He was 25 years old. He was also killed in Ferguson, Missouri. He's the guy who was killed when they say he stole two coats, and that was on August 19th also. He was mentally ill. A white girl was killed, a white woman named Diana Showman. She was only 19 years old. She was killed by San Jose police in California, and they said they killed her because they thought the electric drill unplugged that she had in her hand was some type of gun. So they shot her to death on August 14th, and she was mentally ill. We also have a white man named Dylan Taylor, who was 20 years old. He was killed by Salt Lake City, Utah police officers on August 13th. 2014. Dylan Taylor, they were serving a warrant and they killed him. He was unarmed. All of these people were unarmed except for little bitty knives some of them were accused of having, and also they accused Dylan Taylor of having a little knife, I believe. But all of these people I'm reading to you about are people who were killed and they were found to be unarmed or nearly unarmed when you consider a little butter knife as opposed to a great big military rifle. We have a black person who was killed named Dante Parker, 36 years old, of Victorville, California. He was killed by Taser on August 12th. We have a black man killed named Ezell Ford. He was 25 years old. He was killed in Los Angeles, California by LAPD on August the 11th. He was mentally ill. We have a black young man killed on August 9th. His name was Michael Brown. He was 18 years old, and he was unarmed. We have a black young man killed on August 5th. His name was John Crawford. He was 22 years old, and that happened in Beaver Creek, Ohio, at the Walmart. They released a video to his family and lawyer that showed his murder by police. And John Crawford was actually just shopping. He was on the phone. He had his back turned to the police when they opened fire on his back. And he was leaning on a rifle he had picked up in Walmart. And it was some kind of little air rifle or something, a toy. And they shot him for having something they sell in Walmart. Shot him in the back. So the next murder was a Latino man. His name was Omar Abrego. He was 37 years old. He was killed by LAPD on August 2nd, and that was a traffic stop murder. And then the first person in this list, because we're going retroactive with the dates, the first person in this list was Eric Garner, who was 43 years old. He was killed on Staten Island, New York, on July 17th. And we received word that prosecution is underway regarding the police officer who did the chokehold murder on Eric Garner. Now, I want to caution you that none of these, what I call wrongful deaths, include anyone who died in prison or jail during that period. And that is because prison and jail deaths are oftentimes covered up. It's not that people didn't die in prison and jail because they're not on my list. It's because we usually hear about those murders between 2 years and even 11 years later. And so I don't want to end this list of dead people without telling you about a murder that happened some time ago, but we're just getting word of it. Yes, we're just getting word of the wrongful death of people who died 2 years ago because these murders were covered up until now. This happens all the time, that people who are killed behind bars, because the people have a greater they have a greater ability to hide those murders. You know, out on the street you have cameras, and we have people who have cell phones, and they take video of these murders. And whether or not the police want them to, they load those videos on YouTube and other social media, and they can't very well hide the murders that happen out on the street. But they can and do have murders that happen behind bars. So we're just now hearing about the prison murder of an inmate who died while the guards laughed at San Carlos Correctional Facility in California. It says that state prison officials failed for 17 months to tell the state health department about the death of an inmate at San Carlos Correctional Facility, a case in which correction staff can be heard joking and laughing while the inmate was dying. That happened on March 17, 2013. A shackled and stripped Christopher Lopez died. He was, I think, a Latino man. He suffered from a schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type. So Carlos Lopez died in March 2013, but they're just now admitting that he's dead. They're just now making the report because evidently this man's family or friend may have pressed the issue and they can no longer hide this murder. So this is what happens to people who die in prisons and jails. My brother, Larry Neal, was secretly arrested for 18 days in Memphis Shelby County Jail in Tennessee. And he was murdered on the 18th day, and they never released those records yet. And that's been 11 years ago because he died in 2003. So some people, who died behind bars, they released the information immediately, but not many times does that happen. Oftentimes, because of the greater ability to hide such murders, those murders are hidden from the public and even from families. What do you think about that, Elizabeth?
Well, I myself feel that these individuals that lost their family members needs to bring a class action lawsuit against the government for the wrongful death of their peoples while in the Department of Corrections. United States needs to be involved in that. They all need to sue the government for wrongful death, as well as police brutality and beatings.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Elizabeth, because as a matter of fact, most of these people, because they had the death so long, for instance, they've hidden this man's death for 17 months. And most states have a 2-year statute of limitations on personal injuries. And that's one reason why they had these deaths so long, because if they feel like they can hide it for 17 months, they feel like a lot of lawyers will be intimidated by the short amount of time that's remaining on the statute of limitations. But I want you to know that that has already been resolved. It was decided sometime, I think, last year, that when the police cover up a murder, then it's not the family's fault, and that statute of limitations will not start to run when they died. It will start to run, I think, when they found out about the cover-up. So don't be put off, lawyers. Don't be put off, families, by the statute of limitations. If you had a relative to be murdered and it was covered up, you did not find out about the murder until near the end of the statute of limitations because of cover-ups, you can still file wrongful death lawsuits. So that's a good point, Elizabeth. I want to thank you for bringing that out. And I want to let you know that as you were just now talking about the families of these people need to bring wrongful death lawsuits, I want you to know that there is a class action suit that's going to be filed, as I understand it, against the city of Ferguson, Missouri. And I think they're asking $200 million for people who have been greatly wronged in Ferguson, Missouri. It says, Attorney Shabazz is filing suit on behalf of peaceful protesters in Ferguson who were attacked by police for exercising their freedom of assembly rights and their freedom of speech rights. They were attacked. And so we have Attorney Shabazz filing a suit on behalf of peaceful protesters in Ferguson who were attacked by police. I was present and felt their burn and sting of tear gas. We were hunted by the police for several hours after they attacked us. Most of the younger people were followed by helicopter, which shed a light on them. The police followed the light and shot rubber bullets and tear gas at them. Many were beaten in jail that night. That is what you do not hear on the news. And so, the Black Lawyers for Justice will file a $200 million lawsuit against the city of Ferguson, Missouri, on behalf of peaceful protesters who were hunted down like slaves escaping through the swamps. Yes, they were hunted down like slaves escaping through the swamps. But slavery is over, and we all are supposedly equal under the law, which is not true, and we all are supposedly people with civil and human rights, which are not honored. And so Attorney Shabazz is filing suit on behalf of the peaceful protesters in Ferguson who were attacked by police. What do you think about that, Elizabeth Gaskins?
That's excellent, and I commend this attorney that is actually standing up forward and letting the people know that there will be a lawsuit filed in the behalf of these injured parties that were involved in that protest. That's uncalled for. That's abuse of power. It like slavery. We're not slaves. That was abolished in the day. Today, by him filing this lawsuit, we'll set an example to other states. hopefully it will send a message out to other states that you could be held liable while acting in your official capacity as employed for the state or of that of the state of wherever you reside at as an officer of the law to beat someone or terrorize them in a protest. They're peaceful at a peaceful and just cause rhetoric and havoc upon them. I commend this attorney for suing them. Hopefully he will get more money than what he's asking for, and he'll open up a foundation or a funding for the individuals to call in and other states that have been injured too.
That's a
Mary, am a victim. I myself am a victim of a police brutality. You look online. I filed a lawsuit against Rock Island County, Illinois, in 2004 of a police Henry County sheriff beating me and a mental patient, and I got nowhere in the state of Illinois. Now, this officer today no longer has a job. His fruits of his spirit caught up with him. I prayed about it, and I left it in the hands of the Creator, the one that built me and formed me and put my armor on. I left it in, and he has lost his job today. He no longer is a police officer to go out and injure one as he injured me. He beat me in a state mental hospital, Rock Island, when I was taking a patient there that had bipolar, and he was beat too, the patient, and I applied with the Inspector General in the state of Illinois, and nothing was ever done about my beating.
Nothing was ever done about your beating.
No, I still today am traumatized. I fear my safety with police because of this beating. They know me around this town, and my sheriff here in my county is the one that sent me down to the hospital with the patient. Instead of doing his job, they sent me down, giving some the mental health came over, gave him some drugs, drugged him, and then he was asleep, and I got him down to Rock Island, 60 miles away from my home. When I got there, took him into the emergency, he awoken up, and he wanted to walk outside, and when he did, the Henry County Sheriff Raymond Guzman grabbed me by my arm, and I told him, get your hands off me. I'm a rape survivor. And he took me into a back room and knocked me in the head. And then the police came and arrested me. There were six officers. They were all there. And the doctor attacked me, and so did the other guy attacked me. He knocked me unconscious to the floor. I'm not sure of what he hit me with. My tape recorder was on at all time. I was found guilty of a police abuse, kicking him in his groins. I never kicked Raymond Guzman's in his groins to this day, and he got away with saying that under oath about me, and they all perjured themselves in the transcript. Today, I've not got anywhere with this. But he was found guilty by the state of Illinois as being a misbehaving officer, and he had beat other people up in our state. Raymond Guzman was found guilty by the Cordova racetrack that he was misbehaving as an officer, and he had also beat a bunch of people. He got on the computer, was doing federal information about it. He even put on the internet about myself suing that I was a well-known person that sues police departments. He said this about me on the internet. Yes, I did sue him because he did injure me. I was taken to the hospital after I got out of jail, and the doctor cited several lacerations, bruisings throughout my body, and a knot on my head, size of an egg, where he hit me, and he got away with his abuse to me.
Well, we're so glad that you were able to overcome that type of abuse, because you know why? I know that you've overcome it largely. It's because you yet stand. You're telling us about it. You see, the thing is that they try to use the weapons that we buy, the taxpayers. They try to use the system that we pay for, the taxpayers, against us to the degree that we will be afraid to talk about their overuse of force, that we will be afraid to talk about their improprieties. So even though you have been through so much, the fact that you are still speaking about it, that you're still speaking out against oppression for yourself and others, it shows that they did not do what they hoped to do, because they hoped to shut you up, Elizabeth Gaskins.
That's right. I told him, I said, the big bad wife, get this old granny. That's what I told
him. Praise God. How old were you when they beat you like that?
I was in my, it's in 2004. I've been beat three times, Mary. I was beat in Indiana in 1991 in front of my 14-year-old daughter, and they held a gun to my head, and I filed a claim against Indiana. That's why I left Indiana in 1991. I was beat in Clinton, Iowa in 1996 in front of my two minor daughters, Brandy and Samantha, over a traffic seat belt violation. I was jerked out of it, had a panic attack, and Pat Collins beat me. Tried to mentally commit me, and I filed a writ of habeas corpus, demanding I get a second opinion. I went to Indiana and seen Larry Davis, and he said that the people that was misbehaving was the officers that beat up on me. I was beat over my granddaughter in 2007 at the hospital in Peoria, Illinois, over her having Agent Orange. There was a malpractice done with the baby, and she was taken from us and placed in foster care and adopted. I was beat by Raymond Guzman in 2004. So I've had four police beatings in my lifetime, and these are all documentations that I've been beat by police officers in the United States unjustifiably. And they've never filed suit against me, but I filed suit against them. Dubuque, Iowa also came in and knocked me around, and I filed a lawsuit against them and won that and took $1 out of court for unjustifiable false arrest and Title 42 and Title 18 United States laws.
Well, let me ask you something, Elizabeth. Do you feel like any of your beatings, and I know they beat white as well as Native Americans, but do you feel like any of your beatings you were targeted because you were Native American?
Sometimes I do believe it because I am Native American. I'm small, petite, and they can bully me and intimidate me easier because of my height and weight. And I do believe it's my ethnic background, yes.
That is the usual case, and that's also largely what happened in Ferguson, Illinois, that the people who were protesting were treated so brutally when you compare it to the Bundy Ranch. They were treated so brutally in Ferguson, and it seems like the whole police department is armed with army military weapons, and they used it on the people in Ferguson, but not on the Bundy Ranch. And I'm not saying it should have been used on the Bundy Ranch. It shouldn't be used on anyone, but I'm just making this comparison that others have made. That is because the Bundy Ranch were Caucasian people. They were landowners, they were Caucasian people, and they had a lot of support among other Caucasians, including people in Congress. And they had a lot of support among blacks, too, because we love to see people standing their own ground. But in Ferguson, those people were treated like enemies. They were treated like an enemy state, an enemy nation. They got out the tanks and the tear gas and the machine guns and the rubber bullets, and they killed even another man after Michael Brown in Ferguson. So there's a big difference, I would say, and I'm asking, do you think so, in between how people are treated when they have ethnic backgrounds as opposed to when they're Caucasians?
I do believe some is an ethic, too, and also I do when people stand up before them and confront them, they become defensive, and they become fearful themselves because we're citing law to them, we're exercising our verbal rights, and they feel like that they're going to bump us out of the way because we already know what we're talking about, and they get more aggressive. Like when I told the officer under Title 42, "Officer, I respect the wish not to answer any of your questions. Am I under arrest?" And he said,